Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Today, we're starting our October Breast Cancer Awareness Month reporting, bringing in a skilled surgeon from Western Connecticut with nearly a quarter century of hands-on experience working with breast cancer survivors and their loved ones for an informed and heartening conversation focusing on some of the positive news regarding breast cancer research, awareness, and recovery. Then we're going to return to a subject we've been covering for years now with an important update on the recognition of and recovery from opioid addiction and in the workplace. Our guest from Connecticut's Workforce Alliance Recovery Works Initiative has all the latest information supporting state employers and workers, and a look back at a recent roundtable workshop the Alliance hosted focusing on the issue. Then we're going to close circling back with the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness as promised to get the latest on how COVID-19 is impacting our state's most vulnerable homeless populations and an update on activities at this week's CCEH annual conference. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. Well, you've been hearing about this group since we met them at Connecticut's Farm Aid concert a few years back. I'm talking about Green Village Initiative. Since we visited GVI last fall, and because of the pandemic, their Harvest Fest is going to be presented online with workshops and events between October 26th and 30th. Their goal is to provide fun lessons, learnings, and entertainment with you, the community, and as part of that community, you make GVI what it is today. You're welcome to attend because all Harvest Fest workshops are free and open to everyone. So for your own personal virtual invite to the GVI Virtual Harvest Fest 2020, just click on gogvi.org. As we promised, we're kicking off our October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month programming with a brand new friend to the award-winning For the People, Dr. Elizabeth Reardon. She is a UConn graduate and also followed with a residency in general surgery at State University of New York, Stony Brook. She works in consultation and treatment for benign breast disease, including breast pain, nipple discharge, breast and nipple skin lesions, infections of the breast, and a number of other issues. And she is the director of breast services for the Waterbury Health Alliance Medical Group System and heading up their brand new Women's Health Center. So thank you so much, Elizabeth, for being part of the program this morning.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So to get the grim stats out of the way, which given survivorship of breast cancer, are hopefully not dire or are beginning to trend at least even, if not downward. This year, more than 268,000 women and 2,600 men will be diagnosed with invasive breast cancer, which has spread from where it started in the breast and surrounding tissue. And sadly, more than 42,260 will not survive the disease. But if diagnosed early and treated before it spreads, five-year survival rate plus for breast cancer is standing at a number that we're very familiar with here on a number of our stations, 99% survival over 5 years, which is really, really good news. So,
absolutely.
Elizabeth, thanks for joining us. We're really excited. We got about 14 or 15 minutes to talk with you this morning. So I did want to start out first kind of with the first phase of the interview, talking a little bit about some of the most exciting things that you're seeing as you interact with other professionals in your circle of expertise that are soon to be coming your way or poised to launch that are coming out of breast cancer research.
Well, it actually is a tremendous time to be in this field, and the amount of change and improvement in our ability to deliver care and to help women and men with breast cancer has exponentially increased over the last, especially 5 years. Now, I've been in this business, the the business of treating breast disease, both benign and malignant, for about 24 plus years now. So I have seen the quote unquote old way of doing things and have been able to admire and appreciate all the work and effort that people have put into not only the diagnosis, the treatment, and that's all aspects of treatment, medical, surgical, radiological. So there has been a lot going on in all of those arenas. About 30 years ago, every woman who came to the table, and that 30 years doesn't seem like that long now, does it? You know, came to the table, they were pretty much offered the same type of procedure for breast cancer, regardless of the type of cancer, the size, et cetera, that they presented with. A little bit before that, mastectomy, which is removal of the entire breast, was what women were offered. And it probably saved a lot of people, but it was overkill for a lot of women. 30, 40, 50 years ago, our ability to detect cancers was much, much less. Why? Because our radiology wasn't as good. MRI wasn't used as an adjunct for mammograms and ultrasound. And you know what? Awareness. It's not that women didn't know they had breasts, but the awareness about that we should be looking at ourselves, checking ourselves, going to our doctors, has also really been pushed over the last 30 years. So since 30 years from now, women no longer come to the table and know that they're going to hear, they're going to need a disfiguring mastectomy, including the muscle of the chest wall and taking all the lymph nodes in their underarm. They know there is a variety and they have options. So that's just interesting over the last 30, 40 years.
I was going to say the stigma that so long were facing men who may have detected a lump or found something that they suspected was wrong has also changed quite a bit, too, although the proportion is a fractional to the amount of women. There have been a lot of great advances, including the destigmatization of breast cancer for men.
I couldn't agree more. And I have treated many men in my 24 years of doing this, and the problem with male breast cancer, because you're correct, well, you know, men don't usually quote-unquote check their breasts. It's not something they're in tune to thinking, not as a young man, as an old man. And because the lifetime risk of breast cancer in a man is only about 1 in 890, much, much less than it is for a woman. It's not on their tip of their tongues or their awareness. Mm. And especially as they get older, they're thinking far more about their prostates, aren't they, than they are about their breasts. Yep. Legitimately so, because that particular organ has its issues as well. But the one thing that I'd like to, you know, tell your audience is men who are diagnosed with breast cancer are far more likely to have a genetic link to their cancer, i.e. something that they've inherited from a family member or gone down the chain. Do they all have to? No. But when you hear about a man getting breast cancer, one of the first things we think is, oh yeah, we have to look at his genes more carefully, because it's much more commonly to find something there. Whereas women only really have a genetic link to their breast cancer, and by genetic, I mean something that they were born with that came from either their mother or father's side of the family, depending on the study you read, you know, 5 to 10%, maybe up to 15 in some papers, but far less than men. So, but that's an important thing to consider as well,
and that leads any man who is listening to the show, or somebody who loves a man who's listening to the show, who knows that that man, or the man who knows that they have a history of breast cancer in their family, should add the checkbox of intermittent at least self-examination to their health regimen, right?
I agree. And as I tell all my patients, I don't really care who does the exam. I prefer the patient themselves.
Sure.
But if a loved one wants to perform the exam, I'm sure that's more than acceptable.
Excellent.
I don't care who finds it as long as it's found.
That's right.
Because as you know, with any kind of cancer, if it's found earlier, we have far more options for treatment.
Right. Well, we've hit the midpoint with Dr. Elizabeth Reardon. She's the director of the breast service at Waterbury Health, director of breast services, I should say, at Waterbury Health Alliance Medical Group System, and heading up the new Women's Health Center at the at that location. She also practices in Southbury and through Waterbury Hospital. And so let's look at what's happening today in terms of technology and surgical procedures, and then we'll wrap kind of talking about what happens after treatment. But for let's take 3 or 4 minutes to just cover some of the technology and some of the technological breakthroughs that are not only helping you do your job, but helping more people recover into this 99% ratio.
Amen. So as I mentioned before, our procedures were much larger, disfiguring, and thus fraught with lots of complications. The mantra over the last 4 or 5 years is less is more, and on lots of different avenues. For instance, when the cancer in the breast breaks out of its place where it started, whether it's the breast duct or the lobule, it becomes a problem as it grows into the surrounding tissue and grows into the little blood vessels called lymphatic channels in the breast. From there, that's where the cells have a pathway to the body. And that's really where cancer becomes a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where it goes other places and interrupts necessary functions for life. So again, we used to take them all out because we couldn't predict which ones were the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know we can estimate exactly which lymph node would be the lymph node to have received cancer if it had gotten that far. So over the last 15, 20 years, we have a technology that identifies that lymph node, and it has limited the amount of lymph nodes we remove. It used to be people who had all their lymph nodes removed, their risk of getting lymphedema, which is that very disfiguring, painful enlargement of the limb, the arm of the same side, was, you know, quite robust, 15-20%, and if they had radiation on top of it, it could go all the way up to 40%. Now, by taking only one or two of the lymph nodes that were most likely to be affected by the cancer, we've reduced that risk to 1-5%, which is huge.
Yes.
But now they've even improved it more. We know that if you're an older woman and your cancer is small, we found it on your mammogram, which you were smart enough to get, and if there's no clinical evidence of a suspicious lymph node, either on your mammograms, your ultrasounds, or on your physical exams, in some cases, we don't even touch the lymph nodes, because we know that with a low-level, easy-to-take-care-of cancer, there's no survival benefit to taking those lymph nodes. So even the last couple of years has seen a dramatic improvement what we can offer our patients.
That's
in
great.
Terms of ongoing.
Well, I've got to pin you down to about two and a half minutes to wrap up here, but we don't want to let you go without talking about not only the important work you and your colleagues are doing, but also your partners on the reconstructive surgery and the experts that are making things look great after the fact. What's the most important thing that you want to communicate to folks who may be going into a surgical situation about the good outcomes that will happen after the fact?
And you're talking cosmetic,
physically,
correct?
Cosmetically,
correct.
Physically, yeah.
So oncoplastic techniques, which are plastic surgery approaches combining with cancer to make the outcome look good, has escalated tremendously. The field has been around for 20 years, but the last five, it's escalated. So now myself and other women involved in this field take special courses to do surgeries so that the scar is hidden in cosmetically hidden areas. We're doing mastectomies that are nipple sparing so that the cosmetic result is far more pleasing to women. And we do this in concert and sometimes not with our plastic surgery colleagues who, after we do large resections, they can come in, make everything look great. So it's really been a push from all the societies that this be an important part of our approach to taking care of our women, not just seeing them better and healthier, but to making sure that they are happy with the way they look after our treatment.
Great. I want to close in about a minute, just sending out a message to the sadly growing proportion of younger women and men who are getting diagnosed with breast cancer. A lot of times, this wasn't something you were worrying about till you were maybe even approaching 30, 40, 50 years old and up. But sadly, for whatever reason, environmental, genetic, what have you, I understand there has been a slight uptick in breast cancer occurrences in younger people. So what advice do you have, and when should younger people start becoming self-aware to the point where they might be able to catch breast cancer early enough to join that 99% survival club?
Amen. Knowledge is power. So as early as 18 to 20 years of age, girls should be taught to do a good self-breast examination at least once a month, at least, and to insist when they go for their OBGYN exams or their primary care exams that they get a professional exam as well. Now, for women who are not at high risk, who don't have any family history or have never had a problem themselves, current recommendations are that they should start doing their mammographies at 40, and if they're told they're dense-breasted, that exam is accompanied by an ultrasound to look deeper into those dense tissues. Know your family's history. Ask the tough questions. Know what grandma had. I know for myself, no one wanted to talk about their family history when I was younger, certainly not at the Thanksgiving table, but do it. Why? Because it's important ongoing. So girls who's have a first-degree relative who has had breast cancer, and if their mom had breast cancer at 43, they really need to start thinking about examination, mammogram, ultrasounds, etc., 10 years earlier.
Wise advice.
And they should always consider genetic testing.
Thank you so much. 42,000 plus individuals are going to be lost to breast cancer this year. Thanks to the advice and information from our guest this morning, Dr. Elizabeth Reardon, you will not be one of them if you take that advice and apply what she had to say to your daily health practices. We want to thank you for helping us kick off our reporting during Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Dr. Reardon is the Director of Breast Services for the Waterbury Health Alliance Medical Group System and heading up the new Women's Health Center. Thank you so much, Doctor. Well, as we hit the midpoint on the program, as promised, we're returning to the subject we've been covering for years now with an important update on the recognition of and recovery from opioid addiction in the workplace. Our guest is Allison Quinn, and she is Connecticut's Workforce Alliance Recovery Works Initiative specialist, and she actually holds the position of peer recovery specialist. So we're going to be talking to her about the latest information supporting state employers and workers. And we're going to take a look back at a recent roundtable workshop that the Alliance hosted focusing on the issue. So without further ado, let me introduce Allison. Allison, how are you doing?
Hi, John. Thanks. Yep. Glad to be here.
Good morning. Thanks for coming in. So first of all, just a quick little bit about yourself. How did you get into this line of work?
So as you shared, I am a peer recovery specialist. That means I am a person in long-term recovery myself. So I initially entered into the recovery addiction field through my own personal experiences. I found that there was not a lot of programming when I first got clean. And through this experience, you know, through my addiction, I felt as if I was a major burden on society. So to be able to enter a career where I'm helping others, I feel like I'm giving back and it gives me a bit of purpose.
I always find the empathy from somebody who's also walked the talk is critically important. Maybe not as much to keep folks engaged who have familiarity with it, but to really inspire folks who are experiencing something like you've been through and who really haven't heard a lot from people who have been through it. Did you sustain your habit or your addiction and continue to work at the same time, or were you out of work during your period of pre-recovery?
No, for myself, my addiction took absolutely everything from me, and that includes any form of employment. I don't believe there was ever a time I worked during my active addiction. And when I did enter recovery, you know, a short period where I didn't really know where to begin, you know, you get those feelings of guilt and shame and I can't do this. So it took a little bit of time to get myself back into the workforce and to find a purpose.
Well, tell me a little bit about that discovery, and that it must have been, a high point of at least your career life to actually find out you could not only get back into something, but you could get back into something that both kind of fired up your passion and tapped some of your worst experiences to help so many other people.
Yes, you know, I feel like when I first entered recovery, I had a lot of shame and I wasn't really open about what I had gone through, and I tried to keep that hidden. And, you know, when I found out I can enter this path, it was kind of refreshing. You know, it wasn't just going to work to make the paycheck and, you know, doing what I had to do to find any sort of job. This was allowing me to be myself and to, you know, share my experiences and kind of let other people know, you know, that peer side. If I can do this, so can you. You know, everybody's path is different. Recovery is not a cut and dry thing. And the people I work with, you know, their path might be a little bit different than mine is. But at the same time, we both have gone through those same experiences, and they can have the outcomes that I've been able to achieve.
Yeah. Did you somehow come to and discover this new career opportunity? Or did a mentor or sponsor or loved one who thought you were the right stuff to do it approach you and push you or urge you into getting involved?
So prior to, you know, the worst part of my active addiction, I was, you know, a bit of like a serial student. I've always enjoyed school and college. And so when I entered recovery, I was kind of looking into, you know, what I can go back to school for, what I can do. And I came across, you know, originally the DARC program at Gateway. And I started taking some classes and I found that, you know, I really loved this. I had a passion for it. I was excited about learning and excited about entering the field. So I think just the initial exploration kind of what got me into it, you know.
Mm-hmm. And have you since gained, credentialing or a degree or just the training has brought you to this point where we're talking today?
So I completed the DARC program at Gateway. And I wanted to expand it. I'm actually still currently a student now. I'm pursuing a path in social work. Mm. But through other additional trainings, like the recovery coach training, that's those extra certifications have helped me reach the career I'm at now, and I'm still moving forward.
And where would you like to take it? What's your long-term goal?
Definitely, you know, I think eventually becoming a licensed social worker, and that gives me the option to work in all types of treatment or, you know, just helping people in general. I have obviously my heart has a special place with addiction recovery, as I went through that myself, but I just in general have a passion for helping others, no matter what they've been through, whether it be mental health, domestic violence. So I think that social work pathway can open those doors to just help in general.
Well, gratitude for everything you've already done, and
to the folks that you have already helped. It sounds like you've got a bright and broad future in continuing that mission. So it's great and exciting to talk to you. So let's get into the subject at hand. Let's talk about Recovery Works. What's that all about?
Yes. Recovery Works is a new federally funded job training and service initiative to help those both directly and indirectly affected by the state's opioid epidemic. So the goal of Recovery Works is to connect those struggling with addiction to essential services. Now, what's nice about the Recovery Works program, like I mentioned, it's not just for those in recovery. We ask the question, do you or someone, a friend or family member you know, have been affected by the opioid epidemic? Because as you probably know, addiction is a family disease. And so we're not just reaching out to help those who may have had the problem themselves, but we're also able to help those who, you know, might have a sibling or a parent that was affected by addiction.
I was going to say, I'm so glad you kind of brought that up, and we evolved to this point in the conversation so quickly, because I'm sure you can speak to the fact that it's not only the individual who is working or not working through their period of addiction and the transition to recovery, hopefully, but have you also found, or is there any statistical backup to the concept that loved ones, especially adult loved ones and spouses of individuals in recovery or who are in the depths of addiction are also facing potential job loss or an inability to get employed just because so much of their energy and time is tied up with supporting the person who's in trouble?
Now, I do not have exact statistics, but I can speak from a personal level and just being involved in the recovery community. I know for myself, my own parents, it had an effect. You know, it was kind of a full-time job during my active addiction, worrying about me. And I had a parent in sales, and they couldn't concentrate on their work. It was, what is Allison doing? Is Allison okay? Is Allison, you know, in the hospital? Or when are we going to find her? And it kind of consumes the life worrying about that loved one who's suffering.
So for folks who find support through the Recovery Works program, is this something that is available on a widespread basis throughout the state? And does it cost them anything?
So the program is free of charge, and it meets a little bit of criteria. We're looking for people who have been unemployed 6 months or more, laid off or about to be laid off, or no longer self-employed. And this program actually is run statewide. I cover it for the South Central region, but each of our 5 workforce boards are implementing this Recovery Works program, and they all have a peer recovery specialist such as myself.
And is there also some component of this program that is geared towards employers?
Yes. So we also have a recovery-friendly workplace initiative. So, you know, as we found, addiction has greatly affected the workplace in many ways, whether that be, you know, workplace incidents and absences, just a lack of production in general. Mm-hmm. But with the shame and stigma on addiction, you know, a lot of people aren't forthcoming about they may be struggling, or they're too scared to go to the employer, or they're just not working at all. So we have a recovery-friendly toolkit for businesses and employers, and that gives a lot of great information about, you know, how the business may handle someone with substance use issues and the supports, where they can go to learn more, what are the benefits of having, you know, this kind of open discussion within the workplace that addiction is, it doesn't discriminate. It affects everyone. And if, you know, the workplace can work with those people, they'll end up being more productive in general.
Excellent. Well, Allison, we'll give you a quick break and the folks listening a quick break, but there's lots more to talk about, including how the program works for people, how recovery coaching is happening during the pandemic, and we'll touch base on the virtual roundtable that you recently held with Lieutenant Governor Bicewicz. Yeah. We'll be back right after a quick break, but please do stay with us. Do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news for arts organizations. Connecticut Humanities and the Connecticut Office of the Arts are partnering to provide relief funding to nonprofit arts, humanities, and cultural organizations that are continuing to provide arts and humanities programs and services but are facing financial hardship resulting from COVID-19 or who are committed to advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion work in their mission and operations committed to the Black, Indigenous, and people of color community. These grants are funded through the generosity of the Connecticut Health and Educational Facilities Authority. Support comes by granting a total of $85,000 to these organizations in $5,000 increments, and grants can be used for general operating expenses and no funding match is required. To view the CTH CHEFA Grants webpage for an application preview and full guidelines, visit cthumanities.org/grants. We're back with Allison Quinn. She's a peer recovery specialist leading the Workforce Alliance Recovery Works program here, working with that program in the South Central area of Connecticut. As we heard in the earlier part of the program, she is a peer as a person in recovery. So, Allison, let's get back into it. You see people who are in recovery. How do you apply your experiences and your training to help them overcome the barriers that they're facing?
Yeah, so it's really an individual process through the Recovery Works program. In addition to all the services we offer at the American Job Centers, a participant in Recovery Works also gets access to essential services. This includes one-on-one coaching with myself, family coaching, wellness plans. And, you know, I really work with the customer on an individual basis, and we identify, you know, what specific barriers they're facing, whether that be addiction specific or barriers just in general to reentering the workforce, and develop a plan and focus, you know, on what that individual customer needs to work on in order to feel that they're ready for employment and to find a job.
Did I also see that some qualified clients of the program also have an opportunity to get, some sort of stipend or compensation?
Yes. So we offer training to customers, career training. A popular training amongst my customers has been the recovery coach training that I have completed myself. You know, a lot of people who enter recovery, they do find that passion working in the addiction field. But that's not the only trainings we offer. They're open to a wide range of career sectors, anything from manufacturing to healthcare to CDL license. Mm. And we can cover a number of trainings for those people. And then we also offer stipends and on-job training, which also helps the employer as well, that we can cover a part of the wages if someone is going to an employer for, you know, additional training to get prepared for that job.
Fantastic. Well, how has the pandemic impacted the way you're able to both interact with your customers or clients in the program and continue to accomplish the work that you might otherwise have to do with them face-to-face at some point prior to the arrival of COVID-19?
Like most people, you know, the pandemic created a whole new sense of normal for not just us, but I think everyone. Fortunately, three of our centers are open by appointment, and it's been nice to be able to schedule and see my customers face to face. Now, if they're not comfortable with that, I do phone coaching. We have, you know, the capacity to do Zooms and virtual. So right currently, you know, we can't offer in both ways, but we've had to really make use of everything going virtual.
Very good. So let's get into the subject. Where are we here? Oh, the virtual roundtable, right? This was just a few days ago, if I understand correctly, or if my timing is right. So tell me a little bit about how this session came together and the role that you played in it.
Yes. Yeah, so last week we were able to do a virtual roundtable with Representative Sean Scanlon, Lieutenant Governor Bisewitz, who have been major supporters of recovery programs. And we were able to discuss removing the stigma to substance abuse and mental health. It was an initial kind of introduction of Recovery Works, and we were able to host 40 plus people. We were really excited about it. And during the call, we had a customer of mine, Janine Giardino, who is a person in recovery, and she's actually currently training to be a recovery coach as well. Janine was introduced to Recovery Works, and she shared that it also gave her that sense of purpose. It introduced her to peer support and gave her tools to bridge back into the workforce. Mm-hmm. And we were also able to hear from an employer. We got the employee point of view of Ashley Dwyer, who is a member assistance program director for Local 478, which is the International Union of Operating Engineers. She was clear that every employer has someone in recovery, and the biggest thing was removing that stigma, opening the lines of communication, and making employees feel comfortable coming to talk to you if they have a problem. Local 478 has even developed a support for its members that also includes meetings and one-on-one support.
Well, what else does the Recovery Works program do, or how can it support the larger scale framework that employers have to deal with, where recovery challenges with individual employees are just like a tiny little and quite unpredictable component of their bigger workforce framework and landscape?
So as I shared before, the Department of Labor has put out a recovery-friendly toolkit, and this toolkit gives, you know, resources on how to approach that employee if you think there may be a substance use issue. It covers the importance on, you know, the loss of workforce that we're experiencing by not addressing the opioid epidemic. And we have that recovery-friendly toolkit available if you reach out to me or on our website, workforcealliance.biz/recovery-works. That gives information, and all my personal information is listed on there, and I can send out that recovery-friendly toolkit to employers.
Very good. In closing, let people know again, they're going to workforcealliance.biz/recovery-works to get started. And in closing, once again, if people maybe joined us a little bit late, our guest Allison Quinn, who's a peer recovery specialist leading the Workforce Alliance Recovery Works program down in South Central Connecticut, and by virtue of the fact that she's a peer recovery specialist, she has experienced addiction and recovery, so she is able to really be quite effective, along with a growing number of other peer recovery specialists through this statewide program. So in closing, in the last minute or so that we have with you, Allison, first, send a message to anyone who might be listening who is either themselves in the depths of addiction or transitioning into recovery or in recovery but unemployed, as well as their loved ones whose jobs and well-being may be affected by the addiction of their loved one.
You know, the message I would send out is, you are capable of living a normal life and finding employment. You are not defined by your addiction. You are not defined by your past. And if you're currently in it, there is a number of supports and ways to get out of that. And it doesn't have to hold you back. You're completely capable. If you're a family member, there are ways to cope and to deal with that addiction and still take care of yourself and live your own life.
And what would you say to employers, especially the smaller business people or companies that may be managed or run by, older folks who may not, kind of be as immersed as the younger demographic is in the situations that we're facing right now with addiction?
What I would say to the employers is that there are, it doesn't necessarily have to cost the business to be able to support your employees. There's a number of free programming supports for the employer as well as your employees to really be able to run the most efficient and productive workforce possible. And that just continuing to ignore the problem if there's the presence of one is only going to hurt the company and the employee in the long run.
Excellent. Great advice and a super amount of information from Allison Quinn, a peer recovery specialist with Recovery Works, providing specially trained staff to work with those unemployed 6 months or more who are laid off or about to be laid off and who no longer are self-employed as a result of an opioid crisis. They provide emotional support, recovery wellness plans and community referrals, peer guidance, support groups, one-on-one and family coaching, all blended with other programs, including tuition assistance, paid on-the-job training, transportation, childcare, other supportive services, and opportunities abound. If you need to know more, you can either email Allison at aquinn, A-Q-U-I-N-N, at workforcealliance.biz, or just go to workforcealliance.biz/recovery-works. Allison, our best to you and good luck with the program. And we look forward to talking to you or someone else from the Workforce Alliance about this as it progresses. In the meantime, take care of yourself. Well, we're wrapping up the program and taking a little bit of an encapsulated amount of time because our guest, Madeline Ravitch from the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness, is on the line, but she's sandwiched in between sessions because as we're speaking now on Thursday afternoon, she is deep in the middle of the 18th Annual Training Institute and Conference, which is happening virtually, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. But Madeline, first of all, thanks for being part of the program. I know that we visited with you sort of shortly after the whole COVID-19 really kind of hit the state hard. And now that, the numbers are looking a little bit better and we're kind of poised and wondering whether this phase three launch is going to happen in terms of, businesses reopening and more opportunities for folks without restrictions. Tell us a little bit about what you've seen in terms of the homelessness component going back to early to mid-March, and where do we stand as far as you're concerned and the coalition is concerned here as we're moving toward November?
Sure. Well, so it has been quite a wild ride. It's been a lot to adapt to, obviously. Back in March, we realized pretty early on that the world was changing and that we needed to adapt really quickly. And here in Connecticut, we were really proud that our providers and our state mobilized with incredible coordination to move 1,000 of the 2,000 people who were utilizing the shelter system in early March into hotels temporarily using FEMA dollars. But it was really an important solution because while shelters, we do our best to make shelters welcoming and comfortable as much as possible, these kinds of congregate settings just don't make sense during COVID. And so we needed to be able to move people out into shared rooms, so there were just two people per room. Mm-hmm. So to keep them safe, the people who remained in the shelters were able to spread out enough to social distance, and that was really key during that transitional time. This was not a long-term solution by any means. We do have people coming back from hotels into the shelter system, but we've been working as a coalition to house people. But that's what we always do. We always believe that homes are what people really need, and housing is what people really need. And so moving people out of shelters into homes is more important than ever. What we've seen through our data is that family homelessness has stayed relatively stable. We never know when the other shoe can drop. Single homelessness has risen to some extent, or that's what we've seen in our data systems. And so we are watching it and keeping an eye on it. And what obviously we're most concerned about is that with winter coming, it's going to be a whole new ball game to have to keep people safe and help get people housed without the benefit of the in-person community and touch points that we've known in the past and created as a solution. So it's been a challenging time. That's, I think, what this conference has been so fabulous for, is really giving us an opportunity to take stock of where we are and figure out what we need to be doing going forward.
Well, given the increasing numbers that you just mentioned, and the fact that we never know what any winter day is going to present in terms of temperature and precipitation, how do you possibly line up the checkboxes, so to speak, and try to encompass all the contingencies that may need to be activated, never mind on a day's notice, perhaps within hours' notice, if something suddenly changes in terms of a cold front or a blizzard?
It's all about partnerships and coordination. We have been fortunate that we were forward-thinking and creating a coordinated system years ago, well ahead of what many states have. And this conference has been incredible because we've had people from 30 states across the country dialing in to see what we're doing in Connecticut, which is really exciting. We think that it has something to do with the system we've created, where people aren't going from shelter to shelter looking for a bed, which is an awful thing to have to do. People are able to call 211. We know 211 needs more resources to serve people as quickly as we want to be able to help them, because there are only 6 housing specialists serving all these calls coming in. But the name of the game is coordination. One of the things that's been really exciting about the conference that we're in the middle of is that we have really broadened the net of who is part of this coalition. It's not just the providers, which is what we call the shelters and other homeless service agencies that were at the root of our organization, that started our organization. It's the towns, it's the cities, it's the municipal workers, it's the faith-based organizations. We're all in this together. And so in terms of adapting, we really did make, for example, municipalities a big focus of this conference. We have one of the things that we're working on pre-COVID was we've been working with Sustainable CT through a partnership with the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities, CCM, to launch. We have a Mayor's Homelessness Prevention Task Force led by Mayors Ben Blake and Mayor Aaron Stort of Milford and New Britain, respectively, who are leading the mayors and first selectmen across the state in figuring out what it means to make homelessness prevention a priority, and giving some structure to that, including encouraging towns and cities to pass a resolution to end homelessness and adopt the Sustainable CT certification system, which will include homelessness as one component, really creating a roadmap. But the name of the game is coordination. We also, in our conference, we've been taking a special look at a few different issues that are threads that run through all of our work that we realize we need to take a good look at to be able to build the right kind of coordination, which we focused our conference on. The name of our conference is Housing Equals Justice, which is our campaign name, focusing on racial justice, criminal justice, and economic justice. And we know that we need to be looking at issues for people of color, people leaving the prison system and people who are struggling to make ends meet before COVID to really make things work.
Excellent. Folks, if you've just tuned in and you're getting ready to head into our music programming day or our continued talk programming and news, we're talking with Madeline Ravitch. She's with the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. We've got about 5 more minutes with her before she dives back into Housing Equals Justice, the 18th Annual Training Institute, the ATI, and conference, which happened earlier this week. So, Madeline, looking back on what you have seen and learned so far at the conference, in the last 3 or 4 minutes that we have with you, what are a couple of the aha moments that even somebody as experienced as you with CCEH, found jaw-dropping, if not enlightening?
So this conference has been an incredible opportunity. Making it a virtual conference instead of in-person was a whole new model, and it's really allowed us to, thanks to Bank of America and Zillow, who are our presenting sponsors, offer this conference free of charge. That's made it possible for us to have people from many different walks of life coming together truly on an even playing field where all they needed was a Zoom account. And so having national level speakers together with leaders from communities of color throughout the state, together with people with lived experience who have shown up for our happy hours to talk about how all this is landing with them, has been very powerful. I think that hearing from minors, from youth who've experienced homelessness, which we've done, hearing from people who are leaders in communities where there's just not enough affordable housing, it's really reminded us that this is real, that this is a really hard reality for people experiencing homelessness, and that what we're doing is so important and that we need everybody working together to do it. And I think that one of the pastors from Hartford said it really, really well when he said that the thing people really need is a home. So a special shout out to Bishop Selders, who gave an incredible presentation along with AJ Johnson and Fiona Vernal from UConn. So anyway, great conference. Great to have so many together. Thank you for having us on your show, John, just out there, to everybody out there who's interested in ending homelessness, we want you to get involved with our efforts. It means so much to have partners from all walks of life being part of this effort.
Sure. If we had to, in the last minute or two that we have, if we had to key in on one guest who may have called in from a distant location, what would be the one that made a great impression on you?
I actually, before you finish that sentence, I was going to say I'll name somebody national, but first I want to say something about somebody local, mm-hmm. Which was one of the youth who was part of our panel when kids experience homelessness. She said that people think we're tough, but we don't want to be kids. People think we're adults, but we don't want to be adults. We want to be kids. Mm-hmm. I think that meeting people, that message of that, that people have these ideas about people experiencing homelessness and they don't understand the actual reality, that is so important. We've had great national speakers. We had Nan Roman from the National Alliance to End Homelessness. We had Leilani Farha, who's championing housing as a right on the international stage, together with Saud Anwar from Connecticut, talking about housing. Had Zillow presenting on economic findings with respect to the rental market and what they're seeing there. We had Bobby Watts, who gave a mind from the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council, giving an incredible presentation that I really hope everybody is able to watch on the linkages between systemic racism, COVID, and homelessness, really just spelling it out and laying it down. This Friday, we have a Get Out the Vote rally with the National Alliance to End Homelessness. So great speakers. Donald Woolley had the National Alliance for the Homeless right now as we're speaking. It's been amazing. And just having those national thinkers in the room with the people who are just doing the work every day and living and breathing this stuff and making sure that people have what they need to stay housed, it's amazing.
coming from their annual conference, and we will now release you back to it. Madeline Ravitch from the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness, in partnership with members and communities throughout the state. They are creating change through leadership advocacy and building the capacity of members and the field to respond to environmental challenges. Their collective mission is to prevent and end homelessness in Connecticut. You can get on board with the mission. CCEH.org is their website. Madeline, thank you for taking the time in the middle of this busy day and busy week, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thanks for your great work. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.